Kinnikway by her granddaughter Etta S. Wilson. When Kinnikway, hereditary princess of the Ottawa, was about 44 years old, a childless widow, she married Myangun, a young chief half her age, and became the mother of a son. This son, whose English name was Payson Wolfe, married Mary Jane Smith, daughter of the Reverend George Nelson Smith and his wife Arvilla Almira Powers Smith, and they became the parents of 13 children. The Smiths were of English, Irish, Welsh descent, were of revolutionary stock, and came to Michigan from Vermont. Kinnikway was a medicine woman, born on the ancestral acres in Canada. She had been tutored in the arts of simple herb medicines and the sorcery in which her family and her tribe had implicit faith. Her healing powers were wonderful. She was said to be able to cure cancer, scrofula, and other dread diseases, and she was believed to be able to bring pestilence and death to any enemy tribe which threatened her own, even when they were at a distance. But with all her so-called powers over life and death, she could not save her own family when an epidemic of smallpox swept over the land. She and her father and brothers survived, but her husband and six children died. Childless, with middle age passing, the chiefs and headmen of the tribe held council and agreed that Kinnikway must marry with the hope of bearing a child. She refused. Then they demanded that she marry. Still she refused. She said that there was not a chief in all the tribe of sufficiently high standing for a Wakazoo to marry and belong, and being a daughter of that noble family, she would not wed one unworthy. Conferences among the headsmen and the chiefs continued for some time, while the qualifications of all available chiefs were considered. Finally, her father came to her and said there was one chief whose standing for bravery and honesty, strength and health were equal to her own. He was Myangun, son of Old Myangun, and like his father, bore the name because he had the strength and courage to capture a wolf and strangle it with his bare hands. "I cannot marry him," said Kinnikway. "He is but a boy. As a child, he played with my children." "Nevertheless," said her father, "you must marry him, and if possible, raise a son or daughter to whom will descend your powers of healing." Arguments continued for many days, and finally Kinnikway consented. The two were married in the fall of 1830. The next summer they went southward with the other members of the tribe, and in August they stopped to gather berries on Grand Manitoulin Islands, and there was a son born to Kinnikway. When the child was 3 days old, the journey southward was resumed. The Wakazoo family, of which Kinnikway was a member, were Ottawas, those people who considered themselves far above the average Indian tribes. Their very name, Ottawa, means trader or merchant. They dealt largely with one of the great fur trading companies of the Northland, being the intermediate between the fur gatherers and the fur buyers. The Wakazoos had extensive holdings in the vicinity of Lake Winnipeg, Canada. Tradition or legend passed from parents to children related that the original grant from the Canadian government to this tribe comprised all the area within a square outlined by a day's journey of a horse to the north, another day's trip to the east, and a third day's travel to the south, and a fourth or final day's pace westward to the point of beginning. Within these lines, the tribes lived many years, gradually, however, extending their interests to the south. When the spring thaws came and the water again ran in the ice-locked rivers and creeks, when the winds and the waves of the changing seasons broke up, dispersed and melted the ice on Lake Superior, these Indians left their homes, traveled southward by the waterway, portaging their birch bark canoes from stream to stream, and finally reached the shores of the Great Lake. There they launched their frail crafts laden with their families and their personal possessions, including their foodstuff, their teepee poles and their rush mats to cover them, their copper and brass kettles and their dogs, chickens, and their pigs. The dogs were willing passengers, but the chickens and pigs had to be shackled securely. The return trip in the fall was made in the same manner. The trip, except the long run directly across the lake, was a somewhat leisurely one. Having safely accomplished the laborious and dangerous journey from the north to the south shore of Lake Superior, the travelers proceeded slowly with frequent stops, fishing, picking berries, and otherwise passing the time pleasantly and profitably. Eventually, in the manner of the true pioneer, the Wakazoo and the Mayan guns, with others, crossed from the upper to the lower peninsula of Michigan and found life there agreeable and less hazardous. The winters were shorter. There was the same abundance of game and fish, and the soil was fruitful for the corn and simple vegetables which filled their needs. Furs could be sold to the great Astor Company at Fort Mackinac. Moreover, the inhabitants were of their own kind, Ottawas, speaking the same language, and Chippewas with a similar idiom, all with similar manners and habits of living. Settlement was made at La Arbor Croche, which is Cross Village, Middle Village, which was Harbor Springs, and Little Traverse, which is Petoskey. Pagans, as they had been before this migration, now they fell under the tutelage of the Jesuits. At La Arbor Croche, Pierre Marquette had established a mission, and in this outpost and continuous territory, the teachings of the Catholic Church continued. But dissatisfaction crept in. Many of these savages criticized the doctrines and the conduct of the Church of Rome and remained aloof from the Christian teaching. Then came word of a new religion. Indians passing up and down the coast told of a young and eloquent white preacher, a Reverend George Nelson Smith, who had established a mission at Richland, Kalamazoo County, and was preaching the gospel as interpreted by the Protestant faith. So eager were these red men to have the best that could be attained in religion that they sent missionaries down to interview the new preacher. In the fall of 1837, a company of Indians led by Chief Wakazoo and Chief Shinnecochi went down from Emmett County, met with the Reverend Mr. Smith and others, and an impassioned appeal for the light of religion made by Chief Wakazoo and interpreted by Joseph Prickett, government interpreter. So affected Mr. Smith that from that moment he dedicated every effort of his life to the spiritual and temporal welfare of the Indians. He devoted himself to the study of their language, and because so proficient that his sermons were soon delivered to them in their own tongue without the assistance of an interpreter. The following year, a colony of about 30 Indian families settled in the vicinity of what is now the town of Allegan to form a permanent village under the teachings of the new religion. Among those who joined the little band was old Chief Wakazoo and wife, their son Joseph and family, another son Peter with his family, and Kinikwe, the only daughter, with her husband and son. With exceptions of Kinikwe, all these individuals were embraced Protestantism. Surrounded on every side by converts, she positively refused to accept the new doctrine. The Wakazoos and the Mayan were among the most ardent of the new converts, but Kinikwe remained loyal to Catholicism. In her youth, she had been a pagan. Then she came in contact with the Jesuits, and she accepted the supremacy of the Pope. She learned to read her prayer book and rosaries. She was baptized Charlotte by the priest. The ritual of the church, with the intoned prayers, incense burning, visible cross, the pictures of the saints, and the elegance of the priestly garments appealed to her conception of the majesty and power of the living God. When Protestantism was explained to her, and she realized that the most humble sinner could appeal directly to God from his closet, from the fields, or from the woods, she would have none of it. She had no use for a God whom anyone could approach so easily. She believed that a God should be of some ineffable majesty and aloofness, that a specially trained intermediary would be necessary to present the sinner for absolution. She remained a Catholic throughout her entire life, although yielding to family pressure when it was decided to join the Protestant circle in southern Michigan. When Mrs. Smith opened a school for the women and girls of the mission, Kinney Quay became a member. For a time, she avoided the religious teachings, but looked with interest at the lessons in sewing, cooking, and homemaking. Habitually sitting on the floor, also sleeping there with blankets and quilts at night, it troubled her to have to sit on the floor, on a chair, and she continued to cook her meals in the manner in which she had always been accustomed, using her smaller brass and copper kettles for the dam in a boo, a sort of soup made from green corn in summer or hulled corn in winter, flavored with a piece of venison, bear meat, beaver tail, rabbit, pigeon, or partridge. When wild meat was not available, she used pork sparingly, since she could not endure the taste of salt, and never used a particle but in her life aside from the mere traces coming from the salt pork. Fish and potatoes were often boiled together when in season, and summer squash boiled down with a little fat, and maple sugar formed a delicious dish, not unlike the candied sweet potatoes of the South. Meals were served from one large wooden bowl, the entire family sitting around it, and partaking each in turn from one wooden ladle which was passed from hand to hand. Few of the white men's vegetables appealed to her. She considered onions unspeakable, and later, having acquired a white daughter-in-law, she used to say to her, "Mary, you need never worry about a famine. You will never starve. You can eat leaves," alluding to the lettuce and greens so dear to the palate of the Vermont Yankees. At that time, the staple Indian food was green and dried corn, dry beans, and dried venison when fresh meat was not available. Instead of lard, venison fat was tried out and made into cakes, small ones on which the children might nibble when hungry, and large ones to be used in cooking. Venison fat was easily handled, being hard and firm like mutton suet. Sweets were obtained from the forest, the maple groves yielding delicious products. Sugar was made by boiling down the sap, then stirring it rapidly and continuously when it reached the proper consistency until a smooth, soft, semi-granulated sugar, not unlike the present-day brown sugar, resulted. It was stored in large mokuts, birch bark receptacles about the size and shape of a modern family wash boiler. First-run sap made the whitest and best sugar. The sap, which came after the buds were starting on the trees at the approach of spring, was slightly bitter when made into sugar, a taste which was not perceptible when made into wax, a sweetness for the children. Great quantities of the latter were made every spring, and like the sugar, was stored in big mokuts. The wax was boiled down so thick that considerable effort was necessary to insert a small stick and draw out an all-day sucker. When flour was available at the white man's store, bread was a simple combination of flour and water beaten on a board until smooth and velvety, then molded into an oval shape and baked in the hot ashes of the campfire. Strange as it may seem, every particle of dirt could be brushed off when the bread was cooked. Potatoes were often roasted in this way. Wild berries of all the edible varieties were gathered and dried for winter use. Some apples were grown, but these were the natural, the ungrafted stock, and were small and of poor flavor. Although living in the mission colony, Kinney Quay continued to practice her healing arts. Her huge brass and copper kettles were seething day and night with concoctions of root herbs and leaves, boiling down into medicines, a special concoction in which hemlock boughs seemed to be the main ingredient, made a very effective cough syrup. It was of such pleasant taste and consistency that it had to be hidden from the children lest they devour it. Like maple sugar, it was stored in mokuts of varying sizes, thus adding to its resemblance to the sweets. Other formulas were used to specify other diseases. Her cures were wonderful. In the pursuit of her profession, she had faithful and tireless given her services in unstinted measures, entirely without charge. It was a custom, however, for the patient or family to make her a handsome present after she had served long and well. She had a keen sense of humor and delighted in recalling one case on which she worked long and faithfully. The illness was cancer of the face, and the patient came to her after she had become resident in Northport, Michigan, to obtain the essential herbs and roots from which to compound the medicine. She had to go to Michigan City, Indiana, for in that vicinity only did these rare herbs grow. In those days, there were no railroads, no stage routes, no transportation of any kind, and the entire journey had to be made on foot, relieved only by the occasional offer of a ride by a farmer passing with his team. So strong was her sense of duty that this old woman, carrying her pack on her back, made the entire trip of over 300 miles afoot, securing the plants she needed and returning over the same toilsome route. In the course of time, the cures followed and was permanent, and for this service, the patient, Mrs. Captain Smith, whose descendants by a former marriage still live in Northport, paid Kinnequay 25 cents, but other patients were grateful and generous. Kinnequay was respected for her healing powers, were recognized as she prospered. In June 1849, Mr. Smith and Indians of his mission moved by boat to northern Michigan and settled on the site of the town of Northport, which at first was named Wakazoo Village and later changed to Northport. The old geographies gave the name Smith Bay to the harbor, and this was later changed to Northport Bay. This move to the north was necessitated by the constant friction between the Indians and the Hollanders, a large colony who had come over from Europe and settled near the mission. In fact, the first 16 members of this company, under the leadership of Dominic Van Rolt, spent the winter of 1847, their first in America, in the home of the Reverend Mr. Smith, taxing the capacity of the small house to its fullest extent, yet being welcome guests. At this time, Kinnequay was again a widow, her husband having been killed in a hunting accident. When her fathers and brothers joined a migrating colony, she with her young son Payson cast their lot with them, and on arrival in Leelanau County, she purchased a small plot near the acreage selected by the Reverend Mr. Smith, on which she erected a small but comfortable home, and also 44 acres of good hard wood land about a mile away to be cleared into farmland. All these purchases were made by the U.S. government at the uniform price of $1.25 per acre. Deeds were recorded in Ionia, Michigan, the nearest land office. Close and continuous contact with the white people, a number of such families having settled in the Lakeport town, did not impress Kinnequay's respect for them. From her point of view, they might be fine Christians, but she could see also impardonable faults in them, not perhaps as individuals, but as a class. In time, she came to hold them in contempt and deplored the fact that, as playmates, her son preferred the company of the white children of the village to the members of his own race. Imagine her horror then when she discovered that a love affair existed between her only son and Mary, the eldest daughter of the missionary. She had brought him up to be a worthy successor to his father as chief of the Ottawas, and to this end had in mind a suitable marriage for him among his own people. When news of the affair reached her, she dropped the task which occupied her, and in a furious rage hurried down to the home of the missionary and shouted at him, "I will not let my son marry a white woman and learn to be a white woman's man, to lie, to steal, to cheat, to swear, to go out and get drunk and come home with strange diseases." Then she went on to relate the circumstances which compelled her to marry Payson's father, many years her junior. How for generations no Wakazoo had ever been allowed to marry into the families of the ordinary chiefs. That marriage was permitted them only when a chief or a princess of extraordinary character or attainments was found, that descendants might continue to be healthy, honest, brave, and honorable. Then she added with bitter scorn, "Before the white man came, we went in long journeys. We never had to lock our doors. We never knew what whiskey was, nor how to swear. We did not steal or cheat or lie, and we always kept our word. But after you, the white man, came, we had to lock our doors for our own safety and gather our crops before we went on even a short journey or lose them. Always we had to watch with the eye of an eagle or a hawk to keep from being robbed. In the old days, we used to say to our neighbors, our land ends right here. It's this stone or this tree where yours begins, and our word was good, but when we said that to you, you moved the stone or cut down the tree, always moving your line toward our holdings, that you might rob us of more and more land. And she continued to rave, telling the preacher many things he had never expected to hear, particularly from the lips of a child of nature. And Mr. Smith, almost speechless with amazement at this triad, was equally determined that his daughter should not marry the young Ridman. Honorable as he might be, the parents were in accord, but as time went on, they discovered that opposition merely made the fires of love brighter, and after days of arguments and prayer, the scruples of the proud princess and the conscientious preacher were overcome. Mary's mother ever opposed the matter bitterly and never became reconciled to it. With Mr. Smith, it was a matter of conscience. He also realized that if he continued to oppose the union, his usefulness as a minister of God to these people was ended, for although Kinney Quay was opposed to marriage, the chiefs and the influential members of the tribe were not. Mr. Smith had taught them that God of his ancestors loved all humanity alike. It made no difference whether their skins were red or white. All were the children of God and equal in the sight of such stern stuff was this Vermont man made that he would have cut off his right hand had he been convinced that it would rebound the honor and glory of the Lord. When a supreme test came, he met it with the only possible way of his character and training. He married his daughter to an Indian. Kinney Quay had continued to oppose the union, but finally, on the grounds that Mary was the daughter of the minister and therefore a better lineage than the average white girl, she gave her consent. The young couple were married in the home of the bride on July the 29th, 1851, the ceremony being performed by her father in the presence of all the white people in the village. Kinney Quay did not attend. In Mr. Smith's diary now, in the Congressional Library in Washington, D.C., after describing the event, he added these words, "The occasion was pleasant." So Kinney Quay, with a hatred for the white people, which she took no pains to conceal, saw her only descendant marry into a white family. In time, her bitterness ebbed, and as the years passed, she welcomed and loved every one of the 13 children which were born of this union, her greatest pleasure being to assist materially in their support. In those days and in such an isolated settlement, opportunities for employment were few. Kinney Quay developed her farm, and her son had a small farm and diversified crops. From these fields formed a substantial base for the family maintenance. Kinney Quay continued her medical practice and often made long journeys, returning with her hemlock bark sack carried on her back and held in place by a broad leather strap passed over her forehead, filled with calicoes and other materials to be made into clothing for her beloved grandchildren. Mr. Wolf was industrious also. Game and fish were plentiful in the immediate vicinity, and he was expert in taking both. He served with honor as a sharpshooter in the Civil War, and on his return, he conceived the idea of buying old worn-out horses from the Chicago Street Railroad lines and bringing them to Northport by lake boats, where they were pastured, rested, and fed until they again became strong and useful when he sold them at a profit. Kinney Quay was a beautiful woman with regular features and a fine dark complexion, not tall, but with an erect carriage and dignity which enhanced her stature. She was a conspicuous figure among these people, whose physical characteristics is an asset. Her erect posture, her eyes were black, and her abundant coal black hair bordered her high, broad brow in beautiful waves, and when it was uncoiled, laid in soft ringlets about her shoulders. No doubt it was beauty, being a natural inheritance from her grandmother, a lovely French captive, whose grace and charm were well remembered by her descendants. Her clothing was of the same general style worn in her youth, although the fine soft doeskin, increasingly difficult to obtain, was replaced by modern textiles, short gown and petticoat, leggings and moccasins, or shoe packs. In winter, all were made by her own hands, were habitually worn. The short gown, a garment not unlike a pajama coat, was usually made of dark-colored calico, the lower part being gathered on a yoke. The petticoat was really a dress, invariably made of the finest and best wool broadcloth, English goods imported by the great fur companies, and offered in exchange for furs, always dark or black in color, its lower edge being heavily embroidered with brightly colored beads and ribbons to a depth of a foot or more. Leggings of the same material and deerskin moccasins were also beautifully ornamented with beads and ribbons. The winter shoe packs were made of cowhide or pigskin and were not ornamented. Her outer garments were a shawl, single lightweight for summer, and a double blanket shawl for winter. She never wore a hat, but when protection was needed, drew up a part of a shawl over her head. Throughout the season, she wore the same kind of underwear, a chemise and a short skirt of unbleached muslin. Kenny Quay never learned to speak English. Constant association with English-speaking people familiarized her with the language, and it was apparent that she followed, understandingly, the conversation about her. Yet she never used one word of the language, even when talking to her grandchildren, not unto whom had been permitted to learn their tribal tongue. She always spoke in Indian, and the conversation was interpreted by the younger mother, to whom the language of the Ottawas was as her own. A daughter of the woods, a mystic, a scientific, Kenny Quay descendant of a proud and once mighty people during a short span of one life, stepped from paganism to modern civilization without sacrificing one lot of her pride or self-respect, always adapting her conduct with such understanding and flexibility that she was able to meet and fulfill every duty and obligation to her skillful hands and active brain, thus adding much to the sum total of human comfort and happiness. She lived to a great age, retaining all her faculties and many of her activities to the last, modified, however, by the blindness which shrouded her vision that was mortal of this great woman, lies in a grave in the old Catholic cemetery at Cross Village, where the voices of the birds and the beating of the waves on the lake shore unite in a perpetual requiem.